Greetings to you, my loves. This is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, and we've got a great episode for you today with the brilliant Connor Franta. Before we jump into it, would you please subscribe to my Patreon? If you find that commercials are like some kind of demonic maggot that leaps out of your earbuds into your waxy ear hole and squirms down into your heart chakra and just sucks up all your inner light, then the Patreon for the DTFH is a way for you to avoid those commercials. Not only that, but you can have access to our weekly meditation group, our Friday family gathering, and participate in what is known as the most powerful community to ever exist on planet Earth since the Knights Templar. Today's guest is a really great writer. He's written three books, most recently House Fires, which is fucking great. But being a great author wasn't enough for him. He also happens to be a super famous influencer. But all of that bullshit aside, he's an incredible human being, and I'm excited to introduce you to him. Everybody, welcome to the DTFH, Connor Franta. Connor, welcome to the DTFH. It is so great to meet you.
Great to meet you too.
Man, you are brilliant. Your third book, House Fires, just came out. It is so fucking good, man. Oh, it is so good.
Thank you.
Why do you get to be in your 20s writing like this?
That's so sweet of you. I don't know. I would have never foreseen that this is what I would be doing, but I guess that's the beauty of life, isn't it? That we don't know what's coming and we just take it with grace.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, do you think pre-YouTube, pre-internet, you just would have been a writer, you know? Having these two, like one of them completely new to the entire universe, whatever the fuck an influencer is, this new kind of super celebrity, global celebrity that comes from YouTube, then it's like somehow like crossing what I would consider to be like pretty like classic, beautiful writing, you know, like timeless writing. Is that why it's so strange? Because you feel like when people are talking to you, you have to like sort of hope they understand, look, I don't know what I am.
Well, first of all, I mean, like, being like the grassroots of an influencer and then having to do something in the traditional realms, you do always feel this level of defensiveness of like, no, but I'm different. No, it's good. It's actually good. Or even like bare bones, I have to explain to people, no, I actually did write my own book. I didn't have someone write it for me. And I'm pretending like I wrote it. So there is this level of explanation and defensiveness right off the bat that I wish didn't have to be a part of my storytelling. But it sadly is for most conversations. There's a level of like justifying what I've been working on for 3 years.
I bet I can feel it in the book. I am a little disappointed to hear it's not a ghostwriter, because I'm trying to write a book right now and I would be like, let me hire this person. Oh, whoever they are, they're a great fucking writer.
Hire me. I'll write it for you.
Oh, done. I'm sure you have the time. when you were like conceiving House Fires, did you know it was like upfront when you were talking about it? Did you know it was going to be a combination of poetry and photographs? Did you know in the beginning this is what it was going to look like, or did it evolve into that?
So my second book is very similar in terms of style. It was kind of, you know, like a scrapbook, a collection of this, that, and the other, you know, short stories, long form poetry, thoughts, photos, you know, just like a really, it's like an autopsy of my mind put on paper. And I personally found that format so freeing, because no matter what I wrote, it didn't have to fit within some sort of box of like, this is how you write a book. this is how a book has to be. It has to be this many words. Each chapter has to have this many pages, because that's just how we've always done it. So for me, it just was liberating that no matter what I was writing on any given day, it could be part of the book, even if it was just a few sentences. Right. And that just helped me, I guess, continue the creative process to be free with what I was
doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The format produces this kind of like wonderful lightness to the whole thing. But some of these essays, wow, heavy, like really deep existential questions. And I love that a lot of those questions don't have answers. You're not trying to solve the problems that you're bringing up in the book. And that somehow resonates with the form of the book. It's like listening to pebbles drop into some like beautiful still well and just ripple out. It's so good. And it sounds like you right now are really like wrestling with some tremendously impossible problems that humanity faces. Can we talk about those a little bit?
It's my favorite thing to talk about. I find that like people are so just like skittish and anxious around talking about death and the meaning of life and what happens before and after and like all these questions that I find so deeply fascinating. So although the book does come across as existential, I think it comes from a place of just pure curiosity about the world around us. And the older I get, the more like ravenous I am for not even for like the definitive answer, because I think a lot of life's greatest questions don't have answers. I don't think there is one meaning to life. I don't think there is one answer to what happens after we die. But I think hearing all of the answers is the best part. I love hearing a completely different perspective on an answer or on a question that I thought I already knew the answer to. So yeah, that's kind of what I dive into with the book, is it's just a lot of me contemplating human existence from the perspective of like a 29-year-old in a global pandemic, although I think I only use the word pandemic once in the book because I didn't want it to be about that necessarily.
Yeah. That was something that I thought was really graceful about it, is that, yeah, you didn't mention the pandemic a lot, but you did manage to work in, we're wearing masks now, so it would be, and that's a wonderful thing, because I don't think you want something to be fully anchored in the pandemic necessarily, you know, mm-hmm. it would tie it down. I want to thank Babbel for supporting this episode of the DTFH and for being part of my dream to one day return to Paris. Not as a Luddite, not as someone completely incapable of speaking their beautiful language, but as someone fluent, or at least fluent enough to order a baguette or get in a taxi and not seem like a complete asshole tourist. I want to go to the catacombs and I want to speak French with my wife, cet homme c'est de volionos, which means that man is trying to steal a bone, or ménage à toi. Oui. This is why I love Babbel. Babbel's 15-minute lessons make it the perfect way to learn a new language on the go. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 100 language experts. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, video stories, and even live classes. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. They're really good. You will get addicted to learning another language, and then the next thing you know, you'll experience neurogenesis. Your brain will actually improve. That's coming from me, not from Babbel, but I'm guessing it makes you grow new neurons. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to Babbel.com, use promo code Duncan. That's Babbel.com, code Duncan. Babbel, language for life. Are you familiar with Japanese death poetry?
I am a little bit. Not fully, but enough that if you talk about it, I'm sure I can catch on.
It's just, it had, to me, it felt a little bit like that too, just because, you know, the finality of death when it meets someone like writing their final poem or something like that. And generally these poems, they don't answer any question at all. They just float there, you know, the person's gone and this thing is floating there. And it's like, holy shit, you died and you didn't, like, you were writing about the way a willow tree looks in the wind, or you know what I mean? About the way a drop of rain is landing on your house. You know, like, where's the fucking answer, man?
And I know.
And that, God, that is such a, it feels like that aspect of, you know, human existence is something that you are putting into italics. And I think that's a really curious thing to be doing, and a difficult thing to just sit with that kind of insecurity. And, you know, your most recent YouTube video, and I saw you online tweeting about this, like, you're dealing with becoming a 30-year-old and feeling all of the feelings wrapped up in that shift. I'm 47, so I've, thank God, I've died many times as far as like the age thing goes. Like, you know what I mean? I've had to surrender over and over and over again to like, oh, fuck, yeah. I'm old. But I wanted to ask you this. If you knew for certain that you were going to live, and all of humanity was going to live to be 1,000 years old, that was the new human lifespan via who knows what, some biotechnology or something, how would that change the way that you're currently interacting with reality?
Oh gosh, isn't it, like, wouldn't that be, because you do feel the sense of finiteness the older you get, and you never want to be that person. You hear it, it's such a cliche of getting older and feeling like your time is slipping away from you. It's like a quarter falling out a hole in your pocket.
Yeah.
And you never want to be that person. But I think that is because you have this truly like ticking clock and you can see it ticking in front of you. But if it were 1,000 years,
yeah,
you know, that would be, I just feel like there would be such a sense of ease and the anxiety wouldn't exist within me, because that's such a long time.
Yeah.
Versus 100, or even, I mean, the biggest crisis I had like a few years ago was when I realized I wasn't having a quarter life crisis. I was having a third life, like, because I was like 25, and I'm like, oh no, the average American lives to like 75, and I'm like, this isn't a quarter life crisis.
Oh shit!
So you have a second crisis on top of the crisis.
Yeah.
I think I would just be more relaxed, to keep it really simple. I think it is this ticking clock that makes everyone so stressed and so anxious of, I'm not doing enough with the time that I have.
Yeah, it's like almost like a curse has been cast on the entirety of the species. The curse, of course, being based on this generally accepted lifespan thing, which, by the way, is pretty fucking optimistic. It's like everyone assumes they're going to live to be like their lifespan. Please. People are like falling dead left and right throughout the, not just the pandemic, but generally in history. You know, someone just like, some people don't wake up. Mm-hmm. Some people don't get to go to bed again. Some people have like aneurysms. I'm not trying to freak anybody out here, by the way, but it's like, I've always found the lifespan thing to be a little bit like, oh yeah, really? Well, it didn't work out for my mom or my dad or like lots of other people I know. So maybe you'll get the lifespan. But then by the time you get to that lifespan, come on, let's face it. By the time you're 80 or 90, you don't know what the fuck's going on anymore. You're confused.
And that is such, yeah, that part is really stressful too. I mean, cause so my dad's a doctor, so I hear about everything that you just described all the time. You know, he's telling me, he's like, this person died today, or I met a 20-year-old that did this today. And it's just like, I'm constantly aware of how fragile life is or how quickly people can be like given or taken something somewhere. So it's just like, it's always been a thought in my head in that sense. But it also has made me appreciate living in this moment right now and not like saving for a moment 20 years from now because of how many people don't even make it to 20 years from now by accounts completely outside of their own control, which I guess I read about that a lot in the book as well. But it's like just trying to enjoy this moment and not make it some sort of tally on a board that has to count later on.
Yet it seems like the way that you are at least articulating your experience is not to try to like flower it up. You know, that's another thing I like about it is you're not like, and forgive me if this offends you, you seem to be a teacher of sorts. Like your intent in some of these, and a lot of the content you're creating, it feels really good. And it feels like you're either just trying to like work it out yourself publicly, which is naturally comforting for all of us, or you're like understand how freaked out people are and are just trying to help in some way. But I love the way that you're doing that because you're not trying to make it better. You're just being with that reality. And to me, I think that's incredibly powerful, beautiful.
Thank you. That's really sweet. I never want to come across as someone who has all the answers because clearly I don't. And I also never want to come across as preachy because everyone has a completely individual situation with an individual life and individual weights attached to their ankles. So like, who am I to tell you the one answer to fix something and then lead you on to believe that? And then if it doesn't work for you, feel some sort of responsibility for that. I think like when I started gaining that level of perspective after I came out publicly and after I started meeting people within the queer community, and the simple question that people would always ask me is like, how do I come out? And the more you hear stories and the more perspective you gain from people around the world, people even in super liberal bubbles, it's so difficult for so many reasons for so many people. And sure. Who am I to just tell you, like, just do it. You'll feel better. It's so easy. It's so fine. I don't know what your situation is. Like, I can't give you one simple piece of advice because there are so many factors involved in your decision that really could it deeply impact your life.
What's that like being Catholic with a dad reminding you of the fragility of life, a religion reminding you, oh yeah, not only like is life fragile, but when you die, you are fucked if you are not heterosexual. Were you being steeped in that kind of Catholicism? So on one side you have modern medicine, on the other side you have this archaic interpretation of the Bible, and right in the middle of that you're this like handsome gay kid who is pretending that you're straight. Like, how I can't imagine what that felt like.
It just felt like a storm brewing beneath the surface, because it really, you're right, there were so many different elements of me constantly combating each other but not understanding why, or more so not understanding if everyone felt this way but just wasn't speaking about it. Not just like in terms of identity, but more so of just like, does everyone question everything all the time? Does everyone feel like something's telling me one thing and the other thing's telling me another? Or is everyone like constantly overlooking it and letting it go right over their shoulder in one ear out the other? Because I felt that way constantly of just like, something's not adding up here and why is nobody talking about it? I would sit in church just like twiddling my thumbs being like, why can't I focus on these stories? Because and then like it dawned on me years later of like, oh, I didn't believe them And I also didn't believe half the things that they were trying to teach us, or I didn't necessarily respect the people who were telling the stories. Like there were so many factors there of like, why do I have to sit here in this pew and drink this liquid and eat this cracker and listen to this man? And that is like my guaranteed future, my guaranteed acceptance letter into eternal life. Like, why is it almost that too simple? Something about that just never added up for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's probably a healthy reaction to have to something like that. I mean, I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and I think any kid should not feel comfortable at church, not necessarily because of the dogma or the philosophy or whatever, just because the general situation sucks. You're like, pews? Why? Why not recliners?
Wood. Solid wood. No cushion, no nothing.
I get like back in like medieval times or whatever, you know, throw down some logs, sit down, look at the guy in the road. But like, fuck now. So it's naturally uncomfortable. You know, I was a chubby kid, still a chubby dad. But like I had my belt was always too tight. And it
mine
hurt,
too.
And the belt pain of church children, completely unacknowledged. And then on top of that, you're trying to stay awake because it's the most boring shit you ever heard. It's Latin half the time.
Don't get me started on like a holiday mass that's later in the day, like a midnight Christmas mass. Did you ever have to go to those? Oh my God, no. Torture as a child. Torture.
Torture. Yeah. It's literal torture. And then the thing is, all they had to do was admit, you know, that we're going to a magic ritual. You know, like you know, you want to believe in wizards and sorcery, Duncan. Well, that's where we're headed to. We're headed to a really intense occult ritual that happens all over the country every day where people like eat the flesh of a dead god. Then I'd be like, this
sexy.
Is fucking cool. Yeah, it's sexy, man. Just cannibalizing the son of God. I'll take it.
You get but to drink wine as a child. Come on. Come on.
The best. But so in other words, are you saying like the whole hell thing, you just were like, oh, I'm not buying that.
It just never seemed real to me. And I think to your point, I almost wish it was told from a more fictional perspective. Like I almost wish it was fantastical and sensationalized. To me, it was the whole aspect of it all seeming real and definitive and not magical in a strange way, the way that they were told to me, it didn't seem appealing. So therefore, why would I think it's real if I have absolutely no interest in it? And I also hated the aspect of hell. I'm like, some of us are going to go to a bad place for the rest of our existence and be tortured for not doing the perfect thing. That sounds horrible. I don't want to participate in this. I didn't sign up for this. I didn't ask for this.
What? Wow. This is so somehow you managed your immune system or whatever was strong enough to not get the Catholic guilt that a lot of people I know were infected by.
I still do have. I do get some Catholic. I think it's fading very slowly. It's like a drug that's been in my system for years, and it's slowly wearing off. But no, I mean, I didn't have it as much. Like I would frequently, because we were serial Catholics. We would go like every single Sunday to church, never miss Sunday Mass. And the times that like I couldn't make it to church, we were expected to go to a different service, like a later service. And I frequently just started realizing, oh, I can say, oh, I'm going to sleep in and go to the later service. And then instead of going to the later service, I just go do something else and come back and be like, church was great. Loved that service. That mass was great. And I was just hanging out with friends like in a parking lot somewhere for the hour and I drove home.
Cool.
That was my act of rebellion in a town of 4,000 people.
What? Yeah. Societal pressure, the like just endemic homophobia, all of that aside, what was aside from that, I should say, not all that aside, like I'm brushing it away. I apologize. But
who
what was the
that?
Yeah, well that, you know, just that stuff, just that sprinkling of hellish hate. No, what I mean is like, what was the personally, the if you had to name, and I, again, I'm sorry if this is a dumb question. If you had to name the one thing, what was the hardest part of coming out? What was the biggest boundary to like letting people know who you actually are?
I think an element of it is accepting being an other, accepting being different than, you know, your perceived peers in a way, is that you from that point on, whether you're aware of it or not, are a minority. You are someone that has a different perspective or cannot relate to many traditional aspects of life and society. Like, I'll find myself in groups and be the only, you know, queer person in the group, and just so many things I don't actually relate to. I probably, you know, I can find something that is relatable to it, but it's just not my life or my lifestyle. And every time I chime in, it's from a different perspective. It may be on the same topic, but it's me saying it from a completely different angle. And you just feel different. You may not be, it may not be noticed to other people. There may be absolutely no shame associated with it, but it you can't help but be aware of your otherness when you're speaking about it. And that's, you know, that's like a lasting feeling, even being, wow, you know, I don't know how many years out of the closet now, but like completely comfortable with it. I still, every time I chime in, it's like that feeling. There's like a little gremlin on your shoulder where just like being like, you're the different one here. You're the one that is talking about dating a man and not a woman in this group of all men who are dating women. And you just are overwhelmed by that feeling for just a second, and then it goes away. And every time you bring it up again, it's there, and then it's gone. It's like how a lot of, I guess I'll just speak to like the gay cis male experience, but a lot of us, like when we're even just holding like our partner's hand in public, I still get that feeling of like, is someone going to call this out? Is someone going to say something from across the street? Like, you just have this level of tension always there, and this like subtle fear. And whether that's realistic or that's because that's what you've always been told could happen, could be a part of your experience, I don't know. But it's definitely there, even in the smallest way, which is sad that even is a thing that just exists rationally or irrationally.
Yeah. And an invisible suffering for a lot of us too. We don't, like, straight people, like, one, I think, fantasy a lot of us have is like, I think they worked it all out now, it's fine. The other fantasy, you know, I think a lot of us have, and not just with that, with a lot of other people who are like, what the fuck, you don't even understand. Like, you go out to brunch with your wife, you know, and it's like there isn't like a quality in there of like, you know, there's some potential, probably far away, you know, I'm going to, liberal city, but there's some small potential that someone's just going to decide to punch me. And so I think that's something a lot of us forget who aren't queer or gay. And then, but this is the, in your book, this is the part that you really hit home. First chapter, this unknown future, like you're pointing out, like, yes, there are, like, there have been shifts for the better. You know, there is the possibility to get married now, which is again relatively new, but you made this wonderful point of like, what's the model for that you have? You know, I've got generations and of suffering married people that I can like look at and be like, all right, I know that suffering, but for you, it's different. Like, where's the precedent? You're setting the precedent now. And that is gotta be a heavy feeling. You're like the trailblazer in this regard, you know?
I know. And it was a strange thought to have. And it was one of the it's the first chapter in the book, but it was also one of the first things I wrote for the book. And one of the first, I guess like the very beginning of me wanting to write another book was this thought of how strange it is for any LGBTQ plus person, because there really hasn't been this point in history where a certain level of acceptance is, you know, given at birth for some people.
Yeah.
So you don't have anyone to really look up to, because even the people that, you know, even like the gay men that I know that are married and have families, I'm like, but they're experiencing this for the first time too. They're just experiencing it at 50. So they don't have anyone that is experienced. You know what I mean? Like there is no future to it. We're all experiencing it in the present. So we're all being the first 29-year-old to do this. We're all being the first 37-year-old to do this, 80-year-old, what have you. And that's just a really unique feeling or experience that's so unrelatable or indescribable. And it can either be liberating or absolutely existentially daunting. And it depends what you want to do with it, because I love being kind of like the black sheep of my family, the only gay kid within my three other siblings and, you know, my parents and what have you, because I do have this unspoken level of freedom to whatever it is I do, because my parents kind of know, like, oh, you know, it's Connor. He's doing his thing. You know, it's Connor. Right. He's the artsy one. He's the one who lives in California. He's the gay one. Like, we can't dictate his life because his life is something different than ours. Wow. So there is this like freedom. And I think that I see it as more the liberating than the daunting, because the people around me gift me that perspective as well. Right. So it's why I always hope that everyone else can feel the same type of way. Or have the same type of people around them, because both are possible and potential.
Thank you, Squarespace, for supporting this episode of the DTFH. A website is more than something that you put the menu for your new delicatessen on. It's a canvas. It's a portal. It's a mechanism through which your soul can emanate out into the world wide web. And Squarespace gives you everything you need to experiment with this incredible form of self-expression. You want to make a website in seconds? They've got mix and match templates. You want to send emails to your client base that don't look like shit? You could use the Squarespace technology to design said emails. You want to sell your sweaty, stinky socks online? Squarespace has shopping cart functionality that will allow you to do this very thing. Not only that, but Squarespace has incredible customer support. So if you run into a snag, you can always reach out to them for help. I could go on and on about Squarespace, but I don't need to. I would just invite you to go and look at one of the most beautiful websites existing on the World Wide Web right now, DuncanTrussell.com. It's a Squarespace website. We use it every week. Every time we upload an episode of the DTFH, we are happy to use Squarespace. Don't hesitate. Head over to squarespace.com/Duncan and give them a shot. Try them out. See if you'll like them, which you will. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan and you'll get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Again, it's squarespace.com/Duncan. Use offer code Duncan. You'll get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. Like, looking at just over the course of my lifetime, the shift in opinions when it comes to sexuality in the world, it is like the whole thing gonna go out the window? Like, it's eventually like the whole idea of like heterosexuality, being gay, being queer, being straight, is this gonna be looked at as some kind of weird like tribal paint we used to wear?
How exciting is it that that's even just a thought? Like, I think it's so cool that when you know, more sexual orientations and gender identities and, you know, more of this is discovered or more of this is talked about or experienced or lived. I'm like, that's so cool that we thought we had it down. We thought we knew what we were talking about. We thought it was just black and white, binary, this and that. And then like, it just pops out of nowhere that, oh no, not only is this real, but many people are experiencing this. Many people feel this way and are going to live their lives as this person. And like, we had no idea. So I think when you, in a weird way, like when you give people not the option, because it's obviously not a choice, but like when it's presented to people and it's seen as okay, I think more people are going to take it and run. So I do think that it's going to become much more normal to be anything but straight, because frankly, it's so hard to be anything on the polar end. I don't know many people who are like 100% anything. There's always a little wiggle room. And I feel like sexuality and identity are just inherently fluid in some way. And the more we accept that that's an okay thing and that's a normal thing, the more people are going to be willing to, I guess, experience that fluidity or experiment with that fluidity and feel less shame around it. So I just think it's exciting. I'm like, that's so cool that everyone could be so open in the next 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years that it's anything. Again, anything is possible. Anything could happen.
Yeah, well, you know, I can't remember the science fiction writer, but he was writing about some future way down the line. And in that future, like, sexual preference was actually considered a fetish. Like, all sexual preference was considered, oh, it's a fetish. You know, I have a fetish for this or that or whatever. And, but, you know, again, like, this is where, this is a point of interest to me. The it's not a choice. And I understand that the it's not a choice gets used, or the it is a choice gets used in the most rotten fucking way. It's produced that conversion therapy. It's like destroyed, it's destroyed people's lives. I mean,
yeah.
I think even my, one of my teachers, Ram Dass, I think had to go through that, like, oh, this is like, I'm experiencing some, it was considered a disorder, you know, it was not, you know, and so I wonder, like, sometimes I wonder, well, does that create a like unnecessary boundary for people where they're like, well, I like being with women or I like being with guys, but I'd love to see what, I'd love to experience everything, but it's not a choice. So that would be, you know what I'm saying? Like,
but I think inherently then you're like the person, the hypothetical person is making it sound like they get to decide to want the other gender, to want more, but it's, you know, it's chemical, it's baked into them. It's in their entire being that was already a part of them from the very beginning in a way. It wasn't just like one day they were like, you know, might try that today. I think it's always been there. It's more of just when you realize that it's a part of you.
Oh, okay. And, you know, I see what you're saying. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Oh, yeah. It's like somewhere in you, there's a part of you that wants to be with the same sex. That's in you, whether you want to admit it or not. It's just there. And then you got to a point where you're like, okay. So you're, now this is interesting though, because like here we have like a kind of genetic predeterminism. You know what I mean? And by the way, there's something in DNA that is absolutely terrifying as far as like free will goes, you know, because it's like how much of my children, like some of their, it's like my mom looking at me through them, like literally like the expression, or my dad, you know, in the way that like, so, but yeah, it's a curious thing. Do you have any fantasy about maybe having kids one day?
I do. And I it's hard to imagine without, you know, without like having a forever partner, like someone that I'm like, yeah, this is it, found the person, you know, I can build my future with them. But no, I definitely do. There's a, like when I see my brother with my niece, or I see my friends with their kids, there's something so undescribably beautiful about it, of like the connection that they have and the bonds that they have and the idea of like bringing a little person into this world and teaching them about it and watching them grow and change is just so, so magical to me. So yeah, I fantasize about it a lot. But so, I also don't think I'm anywhere near it, ready for it.
Oh, you better watch out. That's exactly what I said, Fred. That's exactly what I said. I was on the phone with my brother probably 6 months before my wife became pregnant. We wanted to have kids, but I was on the phone with him saying, I just don't think I'm going to reproduce. And now I've got two of them. So I know though that feeling. I mean, so what's going on with that? So you're like, here you are, like celebrity, brilliant writer. And are you just like sort of, you just don't have time for a forever partner? Or is there like, what's, are you running into some trouble with that? Are you too busy?
I think that's the scapegoat answer in a way, or that's like the answer that I always say, but probably isn't the truth. I don't know. I mean, I just find dating in modern times to be absolutely exhausting. And I also find it even more exhausting in Los Angeles or in any sort of really big city. Maybe not all big cities, but it's like a weird time. And it feels like a universal feeling. I've never talked to name one person you've heard say, I love dating apps. They're so great. They're so... They're so stimulating and positive. I've always had person feels that way, but also what other alternative do we have to find people and partners, especially again, in the very particular situation we're in over the last 2 years.
Yeah.
So I think that it's kind of been built up to more that of maybe I'm not in the right place or maybe it truly just isn't the right time, but I'm really not stressed about it. I keep thinking, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And also, by all means, like, I am very young. So, plenty of time.
Plenty of time. Definitely.
I would love it. Don't get me wrong. Like, that sounds great to meet like, a forever partner or whatever you want to call them. But it sounds great. Just haven't found it.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? Like, I don't know, maybe at night when you know you need to go to bed, you're compulsively looking at videos of the volcanic eruption that's happening in the Canary Islands and then finding other videos saying that this could be an extinction level event and then pausing from looking at the volcano eruptions to masturbate to BDSM porn and then going back into watching the volcanic eruptions and finishing your night up with a dive into what it would be like to be incinerated by lava. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your therapist. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches so they make it easy and free to change therapists if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Check out their website. Everyone loves them. They've got zillions of testimonials. New ones are posted every day. You can go to betterhelp.com/Duncan. That's better, H-E-L-P. And join the over 2 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. Right now, my dear listeners will get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Duncan. Thank you, BetterHelp. Yeah, well, those dating apps, man, they're fucked up. They never work for me, that's for sure. Like, you know, it's just something you do when you're horny. You, like, pull up the dating app, and you're, like, swiping and swiping and swiping in some weird dream that, like, but it's never, it's always, right, or it's always, like, at the time you don't expect late at night. It.
It's yeah, late oh, at yeah. night. Yeah, and then I'll wake up the next morning and be like, oh, yeah, I was messaging someone last night. And I'll look back and be like, who is this person? What were we talking about? And they're being like, yeah, we should get coffee today. And I'm like, I don't know you, stranger. Fuck off. Who are you?
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, I'm toxic. Am I like leading people on, or are people too eager and willing to go meet up with a stranger after having like a pleasant exchange for 2 minutes? Like, yeah. what's the right thing here? Should you meet up with someone just because you had a good banter for 5 minutes? Or should you have more self-respect to like chill and meet if you talk to them for a few days? I don't know what's the right answer, but it's a difficult one, especially in the gay community. Like, we have like dating apps in the gay community, or just dating preferences in the gay community, are very particular. People like there have, people have been known to have incredibly toxic preferences. Well, the age-old saying is, and like, I don't believe this, but the age-old saying is no fats, no femmes, no Asians. And that is like a common occurrence on male dating apps, where people have like these strict preferences, and they'll actively advertise it in their bios of like who that they're looking for. So specifically particular that it just feels blatantly offensive.
No femmes? What does that mean? Like, no feminine...
No feminine men, or no feminine... So anyone who's flamboyant or feminine, I don't... Like, what does that even mean, really?
Right.
To me, it just... I see that and I say, insecurity. I wouldn't want to date you, even if you were amazing.
God.
Like, if you were really willing to, like, X out that many people in society just purely... Like, preferences are so strange to me.
Yeah,
in that sense.
Preferences are crazy, right? Now this is like, there's actually one of my favorite, and sorry for folks listening, one of my favorite, let me find it right now. This is, and I can't even pronounce it, and it's one of my favorite Buddhist texts. Speaking of preferences, it's by the third patriarch of Zen. Let's see. Hold on 1 second. And it begins with, the great way is not difficult for they who hold no preference. Mm. Isn't that fucking cool? It's like preference is the devil. It's the, whether it's like dating apps, whether, and even worse is like something about the digital reality is that you are forced to squeeze yourself into a clump of preferences. And it, you know, it starts off where you're like, oh, I'll just write some shit down in my bio, or dating apps in particular, the questions they might be asking or the way you're presenting yourself has to fit into these categories that plug into the algorithm. And I think that's where you run into something that is really malefic, which is the way that the algorithm is grooming us, bonsai-treeing us, shaping us into all these like forms that if we aren't even those things at all.
Totally. I know. And I've never, and maybe, yeah, maybe this is me like subliminally not participating in that, but I never write bios for anything, because I'm like, how am I supposed to describe myself in a sentence? Like, how could I possibly describe anything about me in a sentence that makes sense of like who I am? So most of the time it's like, I don't know, just ask me, which also isn't nice, because that doesn't come across as welcoming, does it? So I never know. Like, I don't like that either. And yeah, you're so right in that I feel like having strict preferences is just limiting you from experiencing the gradient of the world around us.
Yeah.
Like to think that you could possibly know, again, dating apps is the example of like, this is the only person I am attracted to. This is the only person I want to date. You're limiting yourself from so many potential other people and partners and experiences that you could have because you think you don't like someone you've never met.
Yeah.
It's just zeros and ones. You're doing it based upon a picture. You're not even having an in-person interaction with them. How could you possibly know that you're not attracted to them?
This brings me to my next question. If you had to describe yourself in one sentence, what would it be?
Oh no,
I'm just kidding. That wasn't really bad. I'm just kidding. That's not my fucking question.
I fully believed you too.
What a garbage question.
I know. Oh God.
If you had to,
you know, I've been asked that. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've been asked that too. Of like, some boil yourself down into something like that before.
Yeah.
It's just, it's
okay,
impossible.
You lazy fuck, in an interview, and someone's like, "So what are you? Hey, so what are you supposed to know that?"
So what, like, is the book about? So what do you do? I'm like, did you do any, what am I here for? Am I describing myself?
So Jesus. Are you, you're human and I know. But do you pray? Do you have a connect? What is your connection right now with the source, with God, with the universe? Do you have a spiritual practice right now?
I know it's coming across like I'm like a Satan worshiper, but no, I feel like I'm very connected to the universe and to the planet and to living things around me and to life itself. So I feel very like the most free I ever feel or the most peaceful I ever feel is when I'm in nature or I'm in a natural environment. So if I'm just like standing in the middle of the woods and it's just nothing but wind in the trees, animals scurrying up a tree, you know, like just natural sounds, like I feel so at peace. Or if I'm standing, you know, at the beach here in California and it's like no one to my left, no one to my right, and I just hear the ocean crashing.
Yeah.
Nothing beats that feeling. And I feel like that's how I go about life a lot nowadays. You know, I'm willing for it to grow and change, but at the moment it's more of like, when I go for a run every morning or a walk every night, I don't bring my phone with me. I just allow myself to hear what's happening around me or to like sit with whatever's happening within me and just be. And that's my only time where I feel so grounded, so connected, 100% there for that moment. And then I go back to the chaos.
Oh my God, that passage in your book about like your phone not working, going off into nature, that was so beautiful. It was interesting in that you're describing this perfect experience of like being free from technology. And I'm like, this is how I feel. And then literally the next sentence is like, I know that you're thinking this is how other people say they feel. But I do think you like identified this, this growing realization in all of us, which is like, this shit is fucking us up. It is devastating our society. It is like roasting us, and it's not the fires of hell. Maybe it's something worse than that, because like, at least if you're in hell ablaze screaming into whatever the fuck it is, like a cave or whatever, like, you know, well, at least I'm doing something right. Like, yeah. I'm supposed to be hurting right now, you know? So in some way there's some perfection happening here, but these digital fires, it's like, I don't think people realize like how we're getting baked by them.
It's the Zuck. It's all the Zuck. He's got us wrapped around his finger. I know. Every time I get my like iPhone's screen time, do you have that thing delivered to your phone?
I turned it off.
I need to turn it off because I'll randomly get it, you know, every Sunday of like my screen time, and I'm reminded of, oh my God, I'm so addicted to this thing that I'm spending this much time on it. Doing what? For what? Scrolling on TikToks, watching people like eat fast food and people dance, and like, for what? What is it doing? What is it adding? It's enjoyable in the moment, but I, oh God, it does feel just worthless to but a certain extent.
But don't you think you in particular, and you know, me, anybody who has jobs like we have, don't you feel like you're a little more imprisoned by it than other people? I mean, it's not just like you're consuming it for the euphoria of it. Like, you have to be engaged with your audience if you want to continue that, you know, if you want to continue doing what one part of what you're doing. It must be a little claustrophobic.
Or just you have to be in tune with the world around you, meaning like you have to know what's a trend, you have to know what's in the news to be able to talk about it. Yeah, because I mean, it's, I do a lot of live streaming and people are constantly being like, did you see the new Adele? Did you hear what happened to Justin Bieber? And if you don't know anything, people just aren't like, what do you have to talk about that's current? Everyone at the moment is so addicted to now, immediacy, the instant gratification from being a part of exactly what's popular in the second. If you didn't watch Squid Game the moment it came out, fuck you. You know what I mean?
You.
Like, it's fuck you. Like, all of that. You feel that. I think as not even just me, like, I think everyone feels that to a certain extent of just, if you don't keep up, you're going to get left behind. My siblings don't do what I do, but their jobs are becoming more and more intertwined within immediacy, their email being available 24/7, even when they're not working in their hours. It's just, oh yeah, you have to answer this email. I know you're not working, but you have to answer it. Or, oh, someone's trying to schedule this. You need to pick up the phone to answer it. And it's like, you're not working. Why are you working? But it's because they've figured out a way in this American lifestyle to make us work 24/7 without our permission.
Yeah. Yeah. And because I think you're more of a barometer for it than a lot of people I know. Is it just in my mind that there's a growing sense of like, no, this is not the way to live? Or is it just more like everyone's like, no, we are going to fuse with the machine. We're plunging ahead full steam. And this is we're going to like meld with technology. What's the sense out there, man? Are people getting sick of this?
I it's so tough because I feel like it's polarized like a lot of things right now, in that I see people fully embracing it and fully living a tech savvy lifestyle where they have, you know, the Apple Watch, they have the newest computer, they have the newest VR system, they are fully immersed in the digital age and they love it. They love that everything is so convenient, that everything is so futuristic. But then there is this subset of people who are experiencing that as well, but resent it wholeheartedly. And then they become in like almost lost in this cycle of resisting something that's inevitable. I feel like it's almost impossible to not participate. Like, I have cousins that somehow still don't have cell phones in the rural Midwest. And I know, and I'm like, I don't know how that's possible. How is it literally possible for you to not have high speed internet in your house in the 21st century? I actually I can't fathom it because it's so important to what I do in my lifestyle, but I envy it. But then also I think, do I envy it? Because I kind of like everything that's going on here. Yeah. I kind of like my HD camera. I kind of like my high speed internet. I kind of like that access, but it doesn't make me feel good all the time either. So I don't know. It's deeply conflicting there, because I do think the futuristic element of technology is absolutely amazing, but it does leave me feeling worthless half the time as well.
In Tulip, oh my God, what a beautiful essay on depression. You wrote, "It's like I figured out how to reach out for help, but I still haven't figured out how to receive the help I ask for." God, this is how I feel about every time I pray. You know, like when I pray, I think I get my prayers answered, but then when they're being answered, I'm like, oh no, I can't, I don't deserve it. I feel unworthy. I can't take this. Is that part of your depression, a sense of unworthiness, or a feeling like you just don't deserve all of this amazing, like, this amazing life experience, an abnormal life experience that you're having?
Yeah, I constantly feel like I don't want any sort of praise or any sort of attention, or any sort of just anyone to look at me. It's like the antithesis to like what I do, but it makes me so uncomfortable to be singled out or to be praised or to be looked at in some way. So when you need advice or you need help from a friend, like in Tulip, it's like, it's there. It's what I need. I know I need it. I know I've been asking for it, but I have no idea what to do with it now that it's here. I feel completely helpless in that case. And I feel that, I think that that could be just, it could be in, you know, a Midwestern humility where Midwesterners absolutely loathe the spotlight or loathe in any way making a situation about themselves. So even though it's completely justified and worthy of me wanting someone to pay attention to me, there's something like, oh, it's fine. It's a burden on you to give this to me. It's I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable making me feel comfortable. There's some sort of like constantly projecting or assuming what the other person is wanting or feeling or desiring. And it's like this constant string of empathy towards another person that is like completely, there's no justification to that process at all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's one of the most insidious facets of depression, at least from my own experience with it, is that even if you somehow do manage to muster up the courage to tell someone, I'm fucked up right now, the depression, if it lets that slide under the door, it's not going to answer the door when someone comes knocking, because it's like, no, you know, that was just, I don't know what even I was saying, you know? And that's why I think it's like, that's why depression is deadly, is because it just, it like tries to censor every single possible method of connecting with love.
It does. And just you saying that makes me think about so many different times where I've experienced depression and I completely shut out everyone, even though I know that's the wrong thing to do. But at the same time, I don't know if you or any or who's ever listening has experienced this, but every time, like I've had depression for such a long time, I'm not really depressed at, you know, now in this present year, this present moment, but my depression has evolved to a state of like when I'm feeling it, I start casting out lines to people, and then it starts getting worse. And when they bite, I almost resent that they're even paying attention to me. It's like I asked for the help, and now that they're giving it back, I'm mad that they're responding. And it's this strange cycle that I put myself through of like asking for it because I know before it gets me that that's what I need. And then when I'm there, I react in such a negative way to it, and it's almost impossible for me not to. It's just this strange thing. Like there are so many times where that happened semi-recently as well, or like when I was in my most majorly depressed moments, there was this one time that I can think of where I just walked. I left my house and I just kept walking for hours.
Oh my God.
Because I didn't know what else to do. But I was texting a friend and he was aware that this was happening, but I wouldn't tell him like where I was. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sick for like making my friend worry right now about me. But that's also clearly what I want, is someone to worry about me. But how sick am I to make him worry about me, but not to give him a way to make it better or to tell him where I am or anything.
Yeah.
But it's this thing that you're like aware that you're doing the bad thing, or you're aware that you're causing someone harm with no solution, but you can't stop yourself.
Yeah. And your old friend depression, what's it going to tell you? You're sick. Look at you, how sick you are walking down. It's like, you know what I mean? Like that part that's telling you you're sick, that's not you. That's the depression. You're not sick. You're depressed. I mean, I guess we could call it a sickness if you want, but holy shit, man. Like this depression, And I have been depressed. I have had a problem with depression. I've been prescribed medication for depression in the past. I've been suicidal before, a long time ago. I have one ball. I had a ball chopped off because of testicular cancer. And I will tell you, getting radiation for a month, it's a walk in the fucking park compared to depression, friend. I'll tell you that. There is nothing I know of in the world. There's nothing I know of like that. I'm interested in what you're currently you don't have to share everything, but is like your running regimen part of you like doing self-care for the depression? Do you take any kind of medication if you're willing to talk about it? Totally. How do you treat it?
Yeah, I mean, it bites. It's vicious, isn't it? It's one of those things that you can't describe unless you've felt it yourself. It's so painful and it just lingers. But no, my current state is I'm very good. I'm very even. Like you described, I, for the longest time, battled with it and dealt with it myself. And then I started reaching out for help. So I started getting on some medication. I started going to therapy regularly. And all of that kind of brought me back to a level sense. I'm trying to remember how my therapist described it, but it was basically just like, right now you are so low that you can't get back up to a normal level. We need to get you to that normal level because you can't do anything from so far down here. We need to get you back up to where you were just so that you can even like fight. Because at the moment you're so low that you can't fight for yourself. We just need, need help to get you to that point. So for me, how I do that on a daily basis is that I exercise regularly. I will connect with a family member regularly. So like when I wake up in the morning and I go for a run, that's my way of being above the floor. So even if I get knocked down a couple hours after that run, I'm still above the floor. I'm not starting off at the floor and getting knocked down below it again. Wow. And I can't reach back up I can't climb up the ladder. Yeah. So I always set myself up higher than what I would be at without it, so that in case I get knocked down, I don't go back to that place. So it's rare for me to ever spiral anymore because I'm always setting myself up so high that there's like no way for me to get back down there.
Wow. God, I would to have had your discipline in my 20s. I was just laying on a mattress with roaches walking on top of me. I'm serious. I'm not exaggerating. I was just like, maybe I'll kill myself.
Holy shit.
But look, I'll tell you though, earlier I asked you about your spiritual practice, but I think running is like, if that's not a religion, I mean, why not? I've had some of, like, I would say true connections with the divine just running somehow. What time do you get up?
I'm one of those like sick people that if I have something really early in the morning, I'll get up like 2 hours before it, even if it's really early, just because I want that moment of peace ahead of time to like really become myself. It takes like a good hour or two for me to wake up, to feel human, to feel relaxed, and be present. So I love that kind of morning silence that I get in that time. So honestly, between 6 and 7 every morning. And that doesn't mean I'm like out the door running. It's like I'm just sitting, drinking a coffee, kind of meditating in a way, not actively, but in a way it's my meditation, and then go for a run and start the day after that.
Connor, I know you got a book tour and you are so generous to have given me this amount of your time. Thank you so much. It's so nice getting to know you. Thank you for writing this beautiful book. And I can't wait to read your other ones. I'm starting at the end. I guess I'm going to work my way backwards, but it's a real joy to get to know you. Where can people find you?
That's so sweet. Thank you for having me. People can find me at Connor Franta across the entire internet. I'm a lucky one where I got Connor Franta on every social platform.
Wow.
ConnorFrantaBooks.com is where you can get any information on the book or on my book tour. It's in every place you can buy books, so I highly recommend it. And again, I appreciate your kind words. I can tell you are so genuine about everything that I wrote about, and it was really, that's really touching. So thank you for having me and for listening to me and hearing me.
Thank you so much for being here, Connor. And Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Connor Franta, everybody. Check out his book, House Fires. If you happen to be in the city, he's coming through. Won't you say hello to him on behalf of our family? And, of course, subscribe to all of his stuff. Thank y'all for listening. Thank you to our glorious sponsors. I will see you very soon with an incredibly special episode of the DTFH where I reveal a project that the great Johnny Pemberton and I have been working on for about 8 months. I'll see you then. Hare Krishna.